You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The following program is a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hi, welcome. This is Roy Shoman on the show Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that's dedicated to celebrating the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, celebrating the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of all of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. Now, first of all, let me half apologize. I intended to have a guest on, and a guest was supposed to call in. I do have a couple of Jewish converts lined up for the next couple of weeks. I know that's one of my favorite things to have on the show, is to have other Jews who very gratefully enter the Catholic Church give their witness testimonies, and testimony to how God worked in their lives, and testimony most of all to the total upheaval and fulfillment and unexpected meaning and depth and satisfaction of life which becomes available through a relationship with God through Jesus, through the sacraments of the Catholic Church. So please do tune in the next 2 weeks. I have one lined up for next week and one lined up for the week after. Of course, I've had a number of them in the past, and if you want to listen to past shows, they're archived on the Radio Maria website and also on my website, salvationisfromthejews.com. Now, however, rather unexpectedly for this show, I will be talking, I think, about the Jews and the Second Coming. So let me, first of all, give a caveat, which is almost everything I'm going to say, other than direct scripture quotes on this show, is in the realm of speculation. There is very little dogmatic teaching on the details of the, it's called eschatology, the end of times. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, and it doesn't mean it isn't a very interesting area for exploration, and it doesn't mean that it's not a very valuable place to address our prayer to. However, you know, anything that's said too definitively has to be stepped back from, because it is really theological speculation. It's not church teaching per se. Now, if you're familiar with my book, Salvation is from the Jews, one of the big themes in that book is, on the one hand, the Holocaust, which is actually the biggest single event that happened in Jewish history since apostolic times, since the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, and has had a totally formative effect on Judaism. So one of the big themes in that book is, on the one hand, the Holocaust, and on the other hand, the Second Coming. Because we know, and this is dogma, we know from church teaching, that there is, just as the Jews had a central role, needless to say, in the first coming of Christ, they have at least a secondary or tangential role in the second coming of Christ. We know this from the New Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 674 says, quote, "The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel." I'll just repeat that. The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel. In other words, when Jesus wants to come again, he'll have to wait until there's a widespread conversion of the Jews, until he's also welcomed by Israel. So there is at least this mysterious link between Judaism and the continuation of the Jewish people and the Second Coming. So I want to explore this link a little bit on today's show. Now, as I mentioned, it is more in the realm of speculation than I'd like to generally spend time on the show. But if we're going to talk about the Jews and the Second Coming, it has to be in the realm of speculation. So I also should probably preface this with all that we know about the unknowability of the timing of the Second Coming. For instance, from the words of Jesus himself, when he's talking about the Second Coming in Mark chapter 13, he says, "But of that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." Another quote, "It is not for you to know times or seasons which the Father has fixed by his own authority." So that's from Acts chapter 1. That's also a quote of Jesus repeated in Acts So obviously, we don't want to go too far down that road. But on the other hand, there's another side to this coin, which is reflected in a quote of Jesus from Matthew chapter 24, which reads, quote, "From the fig tree learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates." And this is, of course, said in conjunction with a reference to the second coming, to Jesus coming again. So, as Jesus said, when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. What are these things? Well, some of them we know from the words of Jesus himself, again going to Matthew 24. We know that it will be a time of great upheaval, of both wars between nations and natural disasters. For instance, Matthew 24, verse 7 reads, "For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places." Another thing we know about the time to precede the second coming is that there will be widespread hostility to Christianity. Again, from Matthew 24, quote, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake." We know that there will be many false prophets which will arise near the end times. Again, from Matthew 24, "Many false prophets will arise and lead many astray, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect." We also know that another sign, or another thing that has to happen before the second coming, is that the gospel will have to have been preached throughout the whole world. The quote from Matthew 24 is the following, "And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." Now, in almost every period since these prophecies were made, there have been those who have thought that these signs were being fulfilled in their age and that the second coming was imminent. This dates back to St. Paul himself, who seems to have thought that the second coming was right around the corner, and certainly been the a view that has recurred century after century, including among saints and church fathers and so forth. So I guess this illustrates two things. One is the intrinsic uncertainty in reading the signs of the times to determine how close we are to the second coming, but also in some sense that is without much moral fault to anticipate the second coming is near, because even if we make that mistake, as long as we make it in the proper humility and insecurity, then we're doing no more than making a mistake that St. Paul himself and any number of church fathers and saints have made before us. Now, the main reason, I guess, why I'm talking about this is because one of the central prophecies about the timing of the second coming is found in conjunction with the Jews, and in particular in conjunction with the Jews and their presence in Israel. We know from Luke chapter 21 that a return to the Jews to Israel is prophesied to precede the second coming. I do not, unfortunately, have the quote in front of me, the context of the quote in front of me, because I frankly was not anticipating to do this show today in this way. But the central line of the quote is Luke 21, verse 24, "Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." Now, this was literally fulfilled, because Jerusalem was trodden down by the Gentiles, so to speak. In other words, held in Gentile hands continually from the fall of Jerusalem in, depending on how you look at it, 70 AD or about 130 AD, until 1967 AD, when for the first time in almost 2,000 years, the old city of Jerusalem returned to Jewish hands. So that is one of the prophecies that seems to tie the return of the Jews to Jerusalem to the time before the second coming. There's another. Now let me say, I'm going to read a couple of other prophecies, but these prophecies are Old Testament prophecies that can be read in any number of ways, and they have been given various interpretations over the centuries. And so I want to add a caveat to my caveat and say reading them in the light that I'm reading them now is one possible light in which to read them, but is definitely in the realm of speculation. Having said that, there is a rather curious prophecy in Zechariah chapter 13. First, I'll read the passage. In the whole land, says the Lord, two-thirds shall be cut off and perish, and one-third shall be left alive. And I will put this third into the fire and refine them as one refines silver and test them as gold is tested. They will call upon my name, and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people, and they will say, the Lord is my God. Now, it is interesting, although whether it's a fulfillment of the prophecy or not, as I said, is extremely speculative, that the Holocaust actually wiped out almost exactly two-thirds of Europe's Jews. And going back to the Zechariah 13, in the whole land, says the Lord, two-thirds shall be cut off and perish, and one-third shall be left alive. Now, there is a prophecy moving on in Isaiah chapter 66. Again, I want to wrap this interpretation in this kind of shell of saying we are definitely in the realm of speculation. But let me read, first of all, Isaiah 66, verses 5 to 8. Hear the word of the Lord, hark, an uproar from the city, a voice from the temple. The voice of the Lord, rendering recompense to his enemies. Before she was in labor, she gave birth. Before her pain came upon her, she was delivered of a son. Who has heard such a thing? Who has seen such things? Shall a land be born in one day? Shall a nation be brought forth in one moment? For as soon as Zion was in labor, she brought forth her sons. Now, shall a nation be brought forth in one moment? It's rather interesting, although again speculative, that one can say this was quite literally fulfilled when on May 14, 1948, the modern state of Israel was born in a single day following the passage of UN Resolution 181, which partitioned Palestine into the Arab state of Jordan and the Jewish state of Israel. So going back to that passage from Isaiah 66, who has seen such things? Shall a land be born in one day? Shall a nation be brought forth in one moment? Some people have certainly seen this and associated that line, shall land be born in one day, with the birth of the modern state of Israel. For as soon as Zion was in labor, she brought forth her sons. Now, there is another prophecy that is associated by some with the founding of the state of Israel and the regathering of the Jews in the state of Israel. Let me preface this with another kind of warning, which is it's almost undoubtedly the case that if this prophecy does refer to the Jews returning to Israel, that is only one of its several fulfillments or several meanings, because it has always been read also in the church as having a reference to the Church of Christ. However, let me read the passage from Ezekiel chapter 36. Thus says the Lord God, I will take you from the nations and gather you from all the countries and bring you into your own land. You shall dwell in the land which I gave to your fathers, and you shall be my people, and I will be your God. So at least in the context of the Old Testament, being read, so to speak, with the eyes of the people to whom this prophecy was originally given, it certainly sounds like it is a prophecy referring to a regathering of the Jews in the land of Israel. And of course, that happened, that with the formation of the state of Israel, Jews did come from all the countries from around the world and reassembled, regathered in their ancestral homeland. The the final one of these Old Testament prophecies that I will mention in this context is one that also we can certainly imagine that we see being fulfilled in our days, which is the continual fighting over the, over Israel and over the city of Jerusalem in particular. And here is the prophecy from Zechariah chapter 12. Thus says the Lord, lo, I am about to make Jerusalem a cup of reeling to all the peoples round about. It will be against Judah also in the siege against Jerusalem. On that day I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it shall grievously hurt themselves. All and all the nations of the earth will come together against it. Now again, of course, these prophecies have many possible interpretations, and they probably even have multiple true interpretations. In other words, it's typical of Old Testament prophecy to have multiple fulfillments. However, that in particular, that final line, and all the nations of the earth will come together against it, doesn't seem too far off. There is a sense in which if you look at the world's response to Jerusalem, to the Jewish state of Israel, and in particular to the Jewish sovereignty over the city of Jerusalem, it certainly looks like we're close to a situation in which all the nations of the earth will come against it. Finally, the most solid, I would say, of these prophetic foreshadowings of what might precede the relationship between the Jews and the Second Coming, essentially, is what the one that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the paragraph 674 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, saying the glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel. This has in fact been the understanding ever since the Church Fathers. For instance, St. Augustine wrote, in connection with the Last Judgment, therefore, we who believe can be sure of the following truths. The Jews will believe. Now, one of the scriptural sources for this belief comes from Hosea chapter 3, verse 5, quote, afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. Blessed Pope Pius IX, by the way, explicitly cited this passage as referring to the conversion of the Jews in the end times. Now, it is St. Paul's letter to the Romans that contains an extensive discussion of the conversion of the Jews in the end times, and that I will leave for a later discussion. I will just read two verses from that, because they are so central. And this is from Romans chapter 11, verses 25 to 26. Lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. Now, you see in that phrase, the full number of the Gentiles coming in, an echo of that phrase from Luke 21, where Jesus says that Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the full number of the Gentiles come in. So this is referring to that teaching, to that image, that shortly before the Second Coming, or in the days leading up to the Second Coming, the full number of the Gentiles will have come in. In other words, Christianity will have successfully spread to virtually 100% of the Gentile world. All of the Gentiles who are going to come into the church will have come into the church. And then the veil will be lifted from the eyes of the Jews, and the Jews too will enter the church. And that image is extremely widespread, and it's basically based on this passage. I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. Now, I think that is probably a good place to take a break to take a short musical interlude. Be back in a few minutes. ¶¶
You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now return to a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hi, this is Roy Shoman again. Welcome back to Salvation is from the Jews. We've been talking today about the Jews and the Second Coming, maybe even the Jews and their return to Israel in the Second Coming. And I will continue on that theme. Now, I will go back for the moment. I'll go back to Luke chapter 21 because that is, I read one verse out of there, but let me now read that verse in context. This is now reading Luke chapter 21, starting at verse 24. The Jews will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations, and Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And there will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth distress of nations and perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting with fear and with foreboding of what is coming on the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. So we really see here actually the central timeline that is used by people who do connect the history of the Jewish people in relationship to Israel with the Second Coming. I'll just go through that timeline a little more calmly than I kind of alluded to earlier. The Jews will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations. This was literally fulfilled. The Jews in Jerusalem revolted against Rome. There was an initial revolt in 70 AD, which was very harshly suppressed by Rome. And then there was actually a second revolt around 130 AD. And at that point, Rome really lost its patience with the Jewish nation. And the Jews did fall by the edge of the sword, and they were very literally led captive among all nations. They were led into slavery and dispersed throughout the Roman Empire as slaves. And Jerusalem was trodden down by the Gentiles, so to speak. In other words, held in Gentile hands. As a matter of fact, when the Jews were exiled from Jerusalem, when they were taken away into slavery after the failure of that revolt, they were not allowed to approach Jerusalem within the radius of, I think it was about 50 miles under pain of death. And so Jerusalem was very definitely trodden down by the Gentiles, held in Gentile hands from that point of time until 1967 AD, when in the course of the Six-Day War, the Jewish state of Israel reconquered, essentially recaptured the old city of Jerusalem. And then in this prophecy by Jesus in Luke 21, he calls that, or he refers to that time that Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So that suggests that when Jerusalem stops being trodden down by the Gentiles, that's about the time that the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And then Jesus goes on immediately into a description of the Second Coming, a very vivid description of the Second Coming. I'll just repeat that. And there will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth distress of nations and perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting with fear and with foreboding of what is coming on the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. So just a very direct, very literal description of the Second Coming. And that is certainly one reason why many, although I'm again not calling this Catholic doctrine per se, but many, certainly very, very many in the Protestant world, even a fair number in the Catholic world, at the time of the reestablishment of the State of Israel in 1948, saw the eschatological potential or possibilities of it, so to speak, that it might in fact be the fulfillment of this prophecy. Now, we know a couple of other things that have to happen before the Second Coming. Let me just back up and say, I think it's really a good idea to always be aware of the Second Coming, at least in principle. In other words, you know, it might come in our lifetimes, or it might come 20,000 years from now. We really don't know. But we do know some things for sure. we do know that this world is not intended to last forever, that the whole plan of creation after the fall of man was that we would have this physical world, this world that we know of now, which is filled with death and suffering, and human souls would be created. They would be given a time to live and work out their salvation in this world. And depending on how good a job they did, when they died, and of course they all will die or have died, they will be judged and they will end up with either an eternity in heaven, whether it is direct or via purgatory, or an eternity in hell. When the full number of human souls have been created, then the purpose for this created world actually will have come to an end, and things will wrap up, and there will be the second coming, and this world will end, and no more human souls will be created, and all we'll have is essentially the saints in heaven, and God forbid, the souls in a much less pleasant eternity who haven't made it. That's the point of this created world. So it's not intended to last forever. There aren't going to be an indefinite number of human souls created, you know, for all eternity. Sooner or later, that phase of creation will come to an end, and we will have, we will essentially only have the heavenly Jerusalem. We will only have the perfect world, the world to come. I slid past something, which was the association between the second coming and the end of the world. And on one hand, in a way, I'd like to slide past it, because in fact, there isn't a dogma on that. In other words, there's a wide range of acceptable theological opinion about whether, about the timing, the relationship in time between the end of the world and the second coming of Jesus. Will the second coming of Jesus be the end of the world? Will there be a second coming of Jesus and a 1,000-year reign of peace and then the end of the world? Those details are open again to speculation, and there have been saints and they're, you know, perfectly kosher Catholic theologians with a wide range of opinions on that. So, I do tend to equate the second coming with the end of the world. I would suppose you could say that's probably the opinion that I lead to, but that is only one of a range of acceptable opinions. It's not even the dominant one per se. I'm not sure that there is a dominant one. But anyway, the reason why it's really good to be aware that this world is not intended to last forever is, on the one hand, because we see evidence that it may not be good for lasting forever, that the world itself may have a tendency to wear out. And if that's true, that's only a logical part of God's design for the world, because it's not supposed to have, you know, potential to last forever. But another reason is because we do know that there'll be a second coming. And we do know that before the second coming, things are going to look very, very, very bleak on earth. There's a passage in the New Testament which says, there are a couple that are relevant to this. When the Son of Man returns, will he even find faith left on the face of the earth? And another one which says, if those days hadn't been shortened, even the elect would not have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days were shortened. We also know from Catholic dogma, from the Catechism of the Council of Trent, that came out of the Council of Trent in the 16th century, stated that there are three signs that we know will have to precede the second coming. And those three signs were that the gospel will have to be preached throughout the world, that the great apostasy will have to occur, and that the Antichrist will have to make an appearance. The great apostasy refers to this widespread falling away from the faith. And we don't know too much about what the Antichrist, I shouldn't say that too definitively, but there's a lot of speculation about how literally to take the prophecy of the Antichrist, but it certainly seems like an extremely powerful world leader will set himself up against Christ and all that Christianity stands for, and will try to force all of humanity to bow down to him and to essentially follow, you know, worship and obey him instead of a God himself, and that this will result in a very terrible worldwide conflagration, which will look like things are not going out too well, turning out too well for the good guys until Jesus makes his appearance in the second coming. Now, again, I want to wrap all of this in a kind of a shell of speculation, because although these are genuinely passages from the New Testament and from the Old Testament, which most of the church fathers and most of the saints have taken in a fairly literal way, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily meant all that as literally as they have been taken in previous ages. And again, there's this wide range of theological opinion. And I want to be free to engage in the speculation. I want to be free to talk about the speculation of Catholics in very good standing and saints that has been made about these things without wandering into heresy and actually stating something as church teaching when it is in the realm of speculation. That's why I keep repeating this. But anyway, so the reason for being aware of this is because what it means is no matter how bad things get out there, no matter how bad the attack of the church is at a given point in time, no matter how powerful an enemy of all that Christianity stands for might get, and we have seen on the world stage extremely powerful haters of Christianity. One can think of Stalin, one can think of Mao Zedong, one can think of Hitler. And I don't want to get too political, but we may all have candidates of our own, maybe even more recent candidates of our own, of extremely powerful world leaders that seem to have stood against everything that Christ and Christianity stands for. But when we see that, it's not a cause for despair, because for all we know, it is a fulfillment of prophecy, because we know that it's going to happen, and we know that it's going to happen, frankly, worse than we can imagine just before the end times. The same thing with the great apostasy. When we see a falling away from the faith, when we see much of the Christian world turning into the post-Christian world, and a high percentage of Christians and Catholics abandoning their Christian beliefs, it doesn't mean that God has lost the battle. It doesn't mean that things are out of control, that somehow divine providence has ceased to reign supreme and something else is happening. It could just mean that this is the unfolding of divine providence, and this is the unfolding of prophecy, and this is what we know we are to expect as we approach the end times, and that in fact it's going to be even worse. Whatever the situation we're looking at, when you look at the scriptural prophecies about the end times, it certainly looks like the times before the end times will be that much worse than anything that we are seeing or can imagine seeing or have ever seen before. So that's why I think it's extremely edifying. It's actually, I think, kind of gives a false view of divine providence and of Christianity if we think that this world is supposed to get continually better and better, and that it's somehow supposed to be on this steady uphill climb towards a better state of things in this world. That is not really consistent with biblical prophecy, and it doesn't even seem, frankly, to be consistent with history, because history seems to have these cycles of things getting gradually better for a while and then getting kind of cataclysmic and things falling apart and then climbing out of that pit again. It's edifying. Just imagine, I mean, if one lived in Germany in the late 30s or the early 40s, especially if one lived in Germany as a Jew, and you saw this incredible monolithic murderous hatred of the Jews and all of society, all of the institutions of society, all of the government, all of the people on the street, essentially, with this incredible, dark, malicious, darkness in their mentality, darkness in their orientation, darkness in their spirituality. Who could imagine that 5 years later it would all have been washed away, or 7 years later would all have been washed away, and this whole population would have somehow kind of returned to sanity. So anyway, this cyclical unfolding of history seems to be just the way things work. And whether when things get darker, it's the last time around before the end, or whether it is one of these cycles foreshadowing the last cycle, is anybody's guess. So I think that's why it's actually edifying and encouraging to think in these eschatological terms, rather than in itself being kind of depressing. So let me just wrap up for today with the good news. The good news about the conversion of the Jews to precede the second coming, which is that we know that there will be a conversion of the Jews to precede the second coming. So let me just wrap up today. I know I've done this before on the show, but go back to Romans 11, which is the main source of teaching about the conversion of the Jews to precede the second coming, and just quickly run through it as a kind of palate cleanser from what we've been talking about. So, reading from the beginning of Romans 11, the words of St. Paul, I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. So the statement that the Jews are not rejected, that they're not somehow, they haven't somehow turned into the synagogue of Satan, or this, you know, eternally rejected wandering Jew, hated by God because of the rejection of Christ, but God in his mercy, that none of us can understand, because when you get right down to it, there isn't one of us who doesn't deserve to be hated by God. As a matter of fact, there only was one of us who never deserved to be hated by God, and that's, of course, the Blessed Virgin Mary, and the rest of us have leaned on God's forgiveness over and over and over again. And thank God, this is the case with the Jewish people too, God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew, despite their many and repeated failures. So, and then St. Paul goes on and says, what then? Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened. As it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Let their table become a snare and a trap, a pitfall and a retribution for them. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see. And so this is also actually very encouraging and very beautiful, because what it's saying is that the Jews' failure to recognize Christ isn't all on their shoulders, isn't all their own fault, but is in itself an aspect of divine providence. As it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see. So the Jews' failure to recognize Christ is another mysterious part of the Jews' role in salvation history, and a mysterious part of divine providence, but it isn't as dark, so to speak, as it would appear to be if it was entirely their own fault. Then St. Paul continues, so I ask, have they stumbled so as to fall? By no means. But through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. Now, if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? So, again, a very beautiful thought, that it's the Jews' failure to follow Christ, their trespass that enabled salvation has come to the Gentiles. Their trespass meant riches for the world. Their failure meant riches for the Gentiles. But in that case, how much more will their full inclusion mean? That somehow, and I've talked about this at other times, it was the Jews' failure to enter the church that opened the church wide for the Gentiles to flood in. And then when the full number of the Gentiles have come in, the veil will be lifted from the eyes of the Jews, and they too will enter the church. St. Paul goes on to say, for if their rejection means the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? Frankly, I think that that line, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead, is a reference to the great apostasy, that, as I mentioned, the great apostasy will precede the second coming, a widespread rejection of Christianity by parts of the world that had been Christian, Gentile parts of the world that had been Christian. And at that point, the Jews will enter the church, and their entry into the church will serve as a kind of a counterweight to the great apostasy, and will complete the church and make it ready for the second coming. And then St. Paul kind of wraps up with the line that I mentioned earlier, "Lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved." In other words, once the full number of the Gentiles has come in, this veil will be lifted from the eyes of the Jews, and all Israel will be saved, so to speak. That's, of course, the widespread conversion of the Jews to precede the second coming that we mentioned at the beginning of the show. And then I'll just conclude today's show with the conclusion of Romans 11. "As regards the gospel, they are enemies of God for your sake, but as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers, for the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable." So even though the Jews rejected God, he hasn't rejected them. They are still loved by God in a special way for the sake of their forefathers, and for the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. So that's always, of course, very good news. Isn't it wonderful how God forgives us? I mean, you know, the most wonderful thing about it is God forgives us without prejudice, right? If somebody offends against us and we forgive them, I don't know about you, but it's very natural to, even though you forgive them on the surface, underneath kind of, you know, their image has been sullied. There's the shine is gone. There's a dark mark, or, you know, kind of a cloud over your memory of them. There's some lingering grudge or prejudice, but not in the case of God. When he forgives us, you know, we are as squeaky clean as we were before anything happened. And then St. Paul goes on to say why God arranged things this way, or one of the reasons God arranged things this way. So back to Romans 11. "Just as you were once disobedient to God," now this is St. Paul speaking to the Gentiles, "just as you were once disobedient to God, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience, so they have now been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, they also may receive mercy, for God has consigned all men to disobedience, that he may have mercy upon all." You see, so the Gentiles were originally out of relationship with God, so when they came into the church, it was a sovereign act of the mercy of God. But God is so good, and God loves us so much, that he not only wants us to be with him in joy for all eternity, but he wants that to be in itself a sovereign act of his grace, an act of his forgiveness. In some sense, he arranged things that we all pass through a period of disobedience, so that when he welcomes us back, it's just another incredibly vivid manifestation of his goodness and of his grace and of his love. One can think of the parable, you know, of the good son and the bad son, and the father who forgives the prodigal son and welcomes him back. And in a way, it gives more glory to God. It gives more glory to the father to have welcomed back the wastrel prodigal son than he would have had if the son had always been loyal. And so the Gentiles started out sort of as the prodigal son. God welcomed him into the church and received them with open arms and showed his grace and his mercy. The Jews too had to become the prodigal son and go, feed the pigs and live out of relationship with God, so that they could be welcomed back too with all of the love and generosity and undeserved mercy shown by our loving God. And God needed an opportunity to show that to the Jews as he showed it to the Gentiles. So he had the Jews pass through this period of disobedience too, between the first and the second coming. So that's probably a good place to end for today. And I hope that you return next week and the week after, when with great joy and anticipation I'll have some other grateful Jewish converts on the show to tell of the miraculous circumstances that brought them to the fullness and of the truth of our good God in the Catholic Church, and to this infinitely rich and deep relationship of love which he wants for all of us. Bye for now.
You You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The program you just heard was a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Showman.